Welcome to episode number 4 of the Scariest Things podcast, your gateway to horror, terror, evil, and the tropes and trends of horror movies. This is our opportunity to maybe influence you and welcome you into the gateway, talking a little bit about horror films, some of the topics we've covered in weeks past include the scariest moments in horror film. We've covered, what else have we covered?
Our top horror films of all time.
Top horror films of all time. We're just getting going, folks. So this is, today we're going to cover the top four properties. By top four properties, we don't mean real estate, because that would be really boring, and I'm sure there's plenty of real estate podcasts out there. We're talking about properties like books, like concepts, like folkloric tales, like
games.
Comics, like games, like recordings, like
things that we would like to see presented in a film format that currently exists outside the film format that we think that would be good scary stuff.
And we think to ourselves, why in the heck have these not been made into films? And in some cases, there's pretty legitimate reasons, which I think we'll get to.
Yeah, I think what we found out this year in particular is that with the massive success of It, which I think may have hit $600 million in earnings, it's made a lot of money.
Let's hear it for It.
And it opens the door to the mid-budget horror film, something that, you know, they don't need to make superhero budget movies to do horror. In fact, they're traditionally, it's a gateway for young directors to cut their teeth on in the film industry because horror films are cheap.
And we're going all the way back to Roger Corman. I mean, Roger Corman set the stage for a lot of both young horror directors, makeup artists, special effects people, actors. I mean, for God's sakes, Jack Nicholson was in Little Shop of Horrors. So,
right.
So that's going way back. So there's certainly opportunity, I think, in a lot of cases to take simple properties and turn them into horror films. And there's certainly ample precedence over the last 50 years to do that.
Right. And you know, I think that it plays off to some other things that we love besides the movies.
Right.
I don't know how deep the well for Steve. I think a lot of Stephen King's properties have already been translated over. I think one thing that I wasn't aware of, actually, that got released this year and I might be trying to watch tonight is Gerald's Game.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And that's one that kind of got past me, and I'm going to try and pick up on that. And then the third one that they didn't turn out so great with Dark Tower, but
sure. How about the made for TV, the ABC opus, The Shining? What do you think? What do you think about that?
No,
is that a bridge too far?
I don't think it needed to be redone. I think we had talked previously about Amityville, as a movie that we didn't think lived up to its potential and the hype.
And probably needs to be redone for a fourth time.
Yeah, because they redid it again with Ryan Reynolds.
Yeah,
that wasn't a good movie either. I just saw that just skid past me on the on the HBO, and I couldn't do it.
Yeah,
it just didn't intrigue me enough. But I will do if James Wan takes his Conjuring twist to Amityville, I will see that. I mean, that's
listen to episode number 1, and you will get more information on that very topic.
Okay, so back to sort of the properties that, and I think there's something. One of the reasons why I wanted to do this podcast is there's a big property coming out that I'm guessing that a lot of folks don't know what the source material is. But it's a film called Annihilation. It's weird. It is a really weird book.
When did it come out? When did Annihilation come out?
Annihilation, I think, was 2012.
Okay.
And an author, Jeff Vandermeer. It's movie stars Natalie Portman, being directed by Alex Garland, who did Ex Machina.
So it's going to and The Beach.
And The Beach. Yeah, so just
not terribly scary.
But visually, he can put a great movie together. Exactly what to make of it. The book was bizarre and creepy, and it featured a cast where nobody had names. They all had professions, and they all had the disappeared mysteriously or got overcome by the like nature strikes back with a strange vengeance. It's not, it kind of reminds me of The Ruins. There was the movie where the tomb absorbs the people.
Right.
And it has that kind of a thing.
Yeah, and great book, too.
Yeah.
Great book.
Anyhow, but that was, so I knew that Annihilation was coming out. It's a bestseller. It's not an easy read. You might have to drop a couple tabs of acid to get it. But I think
that's not the kind of gateway we're talking about, once again. So you can turn a book into a movie. You can turn a movie into a book. You can turn a comic into a movie. You can turn a record into a book. You can turn a book into a record, to vice versa, and anything else in between. And that's kind of what we're going to try to cover today.
And so what's your, Mike, if we're going to start our death list now.
Yes, let's start the death list.
Of ranking our top four properties that we would like to see turned into a movie. Go.
Number one is a comic book by famed author Charles Burns.
Oh.
Who does some of the weirdest, darkest, strangest stuff you'll ever see. Mm-hmm. It's got a very... Hard to read those books. It's got a very David Lynchian feel to it. This was a book that was... It was a 12-issue comic. It came out in 2005 called Black Hole.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Wow. And basically the story is the aftermath of a sexually transmitted disease that causes gross mutations in teenagers. And... it's obviously a metaphor for adulthood. It's a metaphor for coming of age. It's a metaphor for sexual awakening. It's a metaphor for the trappings of society, how certain people are outcast based on different looks, different feelings, different qualities.
And visually, this thing, it's a black and white book.
All black and white book, and it's really, there's some stuff in there. As Eric mentioned, not easy to read, but B, it's there's some pretty grisly stuff. Not unlike the film that came out last year involving the same kind of topic. Help me out. About sort of the sexual awakening. Not Let the Right One In, but.
Oh, God, stump
up there. Okay. Yeah, so it's a lot like, it has a lot of the same qualities as It Follows. Film set in Detroit, in kind of a rougher part of Detroit, in an economically downtrodden part.
The STD stalks you.
The STD stalks you literally and figuratively. Much like Charles Burns' Black Hole, it's sort of set in kind of a rural... sort of economically downtrodden Pacific Northwest community. It's got a lot of that same sort of dark, I'm not going to go so far as to say dystopian quality, but it's definitely, there's a certain dread to the entire book.
I've got two directors for you.
Yes.
For this.
Lay it on me.
David Lynch.
Yeah.
That would be an obvious one. Or David Cronenberg.
David Cronenberg might be good because he's big on the worms, mutations.
Body horror.
And body horror,
The images of venereal disease in this will haunt you.
Yes.
it is like when you're the eighth grade kid's like, hey, you want to see what gonorrhea looks like? I'm like, not really. Oh, you can't unsee that. That's the same kind of a thing with
Don't open black chapter hole. Number 5 of your health textbook because...
that we could have listed that as actually one of the...
Health textbook. Junior high health
Mama,
textbook.
Mama, what's happening to me? What is this shanker? I don't know.
All right, so number one on Eric's death list is...
Okay, so I'm going to go... And this is... I'm taking a big chance here because I'm going to go video games.
Woo!
Because there's a big caveat.
It has happened before.
There have been no good movies based upon video games ever. And I think that if you go across the properties of what people think is the best one, it's Mortal Kombat
And Pac-Man fever does not
kill. No. Although, another venereal disease?
Maybe.
They've tried. They've done Silent Hill, which is probably the best scary video game that's been out there. It's very haunting. The visuals are stunning. The movie sucked.
Right.
They weren't able to capture it. another one that they've been that has been quite successful, but the movies also suck, is Resident Evil.
Right.
So those are the two big franchises that classically get associated with video game horror.
Right.
And, you know, maybe Alone in the Dark. There's a couple of other ones. And they're essentially run around jump scare. You know, I was tempted to say there's actually... There is a video game out there that made me fall out of my chair, and just the, if you put headphones on, and now if you put a VR headset on, you'd wet yourself.
Which we also don't recommend doing. Yeah,
Dead Space is a very scary video game, but I look at that and I go, I don't think it would translate to a good movie. I think it's just too much first-person shooter action where there's a lot of horrible monstrosities crawling out where I think Dead Space is sort of a combination of Alien and The Thing and Event Horizon. All remarkable movies. This game borrowed a lot from that. I'm going to go a slightly different direction. I'm going to go with one that I think actually might make a good movie.
All right.
There's one of the best, the most lauded video games out there is BioShock.
Okay.
And I think that the environment, it's a 1950s... madman who built an underwater city, and that you're sort of doing some detective work. So it's kind of a little Lovecraftian in that way. Very steampunky. A bunch of crazed lunatics who've gotten hopped up on a strange steroid-like drug. But it features the little girl who's creepy and her protectors, which are these big diving suit behemoths, and that gets your adrenaline going in the game. They stomp around, they crush you. And
is the little girl the protagonist?
The little girl's not the protagonist. She's a bit of a red herring. I mean, you chase her around, sure. And she's but in a way that like the Japanese movies
don't chase little girls around. That's bad.
This is the Me Too environment. Be careful about the Roy Moore moment. But it may not be outright as scary as some of the other video games out there, but it's got a great story.
All right.
And I think
BioShock.
That they can, it looks, it's beautiful. It's an absolutely beautiful game. It has some jump scare potential. It's creepy. So it sort of would be on the edge like an adventure horror movie. Anyway, so
okay,
that's my wish if they're going to try to be
in
these games.
What is the BioShock punchline?
The BioShock punchline is that it's... That the giant robot monster things that are protecting the little girls, it's all this interconnected. It's like the ghost of a child that was that haunted the man who created the whole complex.
Okay,
and then the very end, it has an ambiguous ending. It actually follows up. There's a better story is the follow up. Which has a very political overtone. It's called BioShock Infinite. Totally different podcast. Not really a horror thing.
Yeah.
But that has a brilliant punchline. This one not so punchline-y, but a super environment.
All right. Go to your local arcade, get a pocket full of quarters,
and play
BioShock.
Mr. Campbell has not played many computer games in the last couple of decades.
Lots of quarters. All right. So number two for me, the 1973... Marvel property.
Oh boy,
Son of Satan.
Oh, okay.
It's got Satan in the title, so like that's scary to begin with. Who isn't frightened by Satan? So in 1973, Stan Lee, when he was a strapping young lad, now of what, 95 years old, 96 years old, he saw the success. They had a lot of success in the early 70s with Ghost Rider, with Tomb of Dracula, mm-hmm. with some other sort of lesser properties.
This is sort of in the grindhouse area for Marvel.
Yeah, it was.
At the same time that Power Man and Iron Fist
yep.
and Master of Kung Fu came out, and they were all getting in on that grindhouse action movie kind of a thing, and so this close cousins to the horror.
Oh yeah, genre. absolutely, and they saw all that came to fruition with Son of Satan, which is basically it's a story about Damien Hellstrom, and he is essentially his mom is mortal, his dad is Satan. Very simple story, and which is what I like about it. It's got a lot of psychedelic overtones, but it's essentially this sort of Greek tragedy of this person who is half Satan trying to rebuke trying to get out from the cloven hoof of his father, right? He's trying to be not like his father. He's actually trying to be a good person.
So this is a precursor to Hellboy.
It is kind of a precursor to Hellboy, right?
The devil who doesn't want to be a devil.
The devil who doesn't want to be a devil. And of course, the son of Satan, it morphs in over the course of the years, and he becomes an integral member of the Defenders. Why in the hell they didn't resurrect the son of Satan in the current incantation of the Defenders, I have no idea.
I'll give you one reason. Disney,
right.
I think you're totally right. I think the chance that you would have had for son of Satan would have been if Fox, because the recent Fox Disney merger has killed that opportunity. It'll be interesting to see how many R-rated movies that Marvel's going to continue to put out with Deadpool and, Logan and Deadpool, two of the best superhero movies ever.
Right.
Rated R movies.
Right.
Son of Satan could have joined that fray.
Oh, absolutely.
And particularly when they're starting to go, what other properties have we not used?
Right. Right.
The hope is that they would do something like that, but it's not Disney's MO.
No. And they've done some other films, like I think of things like Spawn, which kind of had that it sort of had that sort of otherworldly quality. They sort of flip-flop in and out of hell. The Son of Satan has some of those elements, but if done right and done with sort of the early 70s sort of psychedelic vibe. Sure. It could be kind of an interesting, and it is, as I say, it's ultimately sort of this like Greek tragedy. It's the father or the son rather trying to get out from under the father, and that's a great story no matter how you tell it. And if you tell it with a little bit of terror, a little bit of fright behind it,
well, I think one of the opportunities you have is Doctor Strange came out, and that sort of opened up sort of the Marvel's Mystic Universe,
right? Same genre.
Everything takes place in New York.
Yeah.
And then you could dovetail some of these things. He would be an awkward fit to the current makeup of the Avengers, but then again, at this point, if they're going to blend him with Guardians, they're willing to do almost anything.
What the hell? And Marvel, if you're listening, please keep his costume. His costume is so badass. I know this is a podcast, but folks, get online, Google Son of Satan, and you will see one heck of a superhero costume. Number two for Eric is...
I'm going to go with a fairly recent novel. This is a book by Justin Cronin done in 2010, and it's The Passage.
Ooh.
You heard of The Passage?
I have heard of The Passage,
okay, so yeah. this is a vampire apocalypse.
Right.
And it's akin to a zombie apocalypse in the way that they play it out. This isn't your sexy Fright Night, Dracula kind of a vampire. These are mutant bat things that are almost indestructible.
Dig it.
Led by this one that has a mind telepathic control aspect to it.
And psionic capabilities.
It does some other classic fabulous tropes, which are, it's a the military gets a hold of a virus, that someone gets infected by a weird bat thing. They figure out, they distill the strain of whatever this is, and they start injecting it into other into criminals, of course, because they got nothing left to live for, and they can experiment on them.
I dig it.
It reminds me of, I think, like The Strain, which recently they've made into a television show. The book is divided up into two halves, where the first is the origin story of how did this virus break loose, how did these vampires, they take over the world, essentially. It's just a virulent strain, and it wipes most of humanity out. So the second half of the book is more of a survivor's tale of trying to rebuild society, and so it has a lot of Walking Dead feel to it. It's a huge book.
Yeah,
I mean it's a
We're talking Gulag Archipelago.
Yeah, it's the Stand level size book.
Okay,
I actually though. In truth, I did audiobook.
Okay. So, take some time off works, folks.
Yep. And it took me a month to listen to it, and it was totally worth it. It was a really the story is very, the characters are really well described.
Right.
I think it has it pays homages to a lot of things like the zombie genre.
Sure.
And
which we might be covering on a future podcast. Hint, hint.
Nudge, nudge. Wink, wink, say no more. I'd say kind of Walking Dead meets Mad Max meets Nosferatu.
So, like it. Yeah, I like it. I dig it.
It's compelling. It. Epic treks, scary villains, sweeping scopes. This is probably a trilogy if anybody tries to pull this thing off.
Okay.
Seeing that what they just did with It.
Yep.
Took a big book, cut it in half.
Yep.
They could do something like that with this.
Absolutely.
I don't know. I think somebody's been trying to pick this up. It was a bestseller.
Right.
So I think it's a, of current hot novels, this one is one that could make a splash if they ever convert it.
Cool.
You're
cool.
Number three.
I'm going big. Big, big, big. And this is something that's been tried. This is the ultimate biting off more than you can chew.
Okay.
I am, of course, talking about the H.P. Lovecraft film At the Mountains of Madness.
Oh, no! That's my number.
This is a first, folks. Ding, 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 ding. Eric and I have, as you all know, this podcast is completely extemporaneous, and this is the first time we've ever doubled up. So this is perfect. So
I'll share my thoughts on it, but you start off.
So this of course is the 1931 book that H.P. Lovecraft was paid. Guess how much he was paid to write this story?
It was like $350 or something.
$315 to write this story. This, of course, is a disastrous expedition to Antarctica featuring Dr. William Dyer from Miskatonic U trying desperately, as he's telling the story of his horrible, horrible expedition, trying to dissuade others from the journey. They discover an ancient ruins. They discover the Elder Things. There's all sorts of great allegory to ancient astronauts, which I love. It's got sort of a. It's got, of course, it's got all your regular H.P. Lovecraft.
All the Lovecraft notes. I think.
It hits everything.
The Necronomicon's included, and they have the big monsters like the Shoggoths are in there, and the Starspawn, and the Elder Things, which are some of the weirdest looking. And he does a really good job of describing how strange these, like they're shaped like ridged barrels with starfish on their heads and tentacles. They're just all the drippy, gooey kind of Lovecraftian stuff that you sort of. I think now that it's public domain. I mean, there's so much Lovecraft stuff that's out there.
Oh yeah. So in 2010, I think in case you don't know, Guillermo del Toro he gave it a go. And Hollywood basically came back to him and said, okay, look, three strikes. It's a hard R at best, probably. Mm-hmm. And he wanted it to be a hard R. There's literally no love story, and it's got a horrible, horrible ending, which is like no ending.
the other thing that scared him off is he wanted to treat this like a James Cameron movie. He wanted $150 million to do it.
Right.
And they went, ooh, no. He had Tom Cruise lined up.
Right.
So this thing was ready to go. Mm-hmm. They even
went so far as to do, like, apparently hundreds and hundreds of pieces of artwork.
Yes.
That have not been shown publicly, as far as I know.
Not yet. But here's the thing that keeps me optimistic.
Lay it on me.
He's got The Shape of Water currently in theaters, and it's going to be Oscar bait. It is Oscar bait. Sure. It is. I haven't seen it yet.
I haven't either.
I intend
looks
to.
Looks good. Looks super good.
But it is Guillermo del Toro doing his fantasy horror type of thing, and it's. If he snags a best director, not even a nomination for it, because then he has. I think his last was Red. He did last year one that wasn't well received.
Sure.
It's killing me what the name of the thing was, but
pass.
next.
Pass.
But I think that he can burnish his reputation because he. If he can lower that budget, if he can get that budget under $100 million, I think it, going back to our original conversation, has proved that a good horror property translated by a good director with a good cast and a proper budget can make a lot of money. Now, I don't know how, you know, I think within the horror genre, Lovecraft is common knowledge. And I think within some things like board games, because it's now open property, there's a ton of people doing Cthulhu stuff, right? And sometimes it's cute, sometimes it's, but sometimes they take it very seriously. And so I think it's saturating the stream of consciousness that's out there.
Right.
I really hope this is his. This is the story that has the best chance to get translate to make it to the screen.
Right.
A lot of the stuff that Lovecraft does is the psychological, mind twisty, sanity check level of storytelling. It's hard to make it compelling, and nobody's really given it a big budget go.
Right. No. So where does Cthulhu fit in with Scientology?
Well, so I think that would be great if Tom Cruise was doing the press tour. It's like, so Tom,
tell us. There's a lot of crossovers here.
At what point do you actually
lay it on us.
Do you wake the sleeping god?
Yes. All right. So we covered that one. Was that your number one? That was your number. Well, what do you got next?
Okay. So my number two.
now number one.
Now number one. Because Mike and I just shared this with you. Is a comic book.
Oh.
And this was, and as I have a prop that you folks can't see, but it is Lock and Key by Joe Hill, art by Gabriel Rodriguez, and published by IDW. This is the Eisner winner for the best limited series in 2009, and Joe Hill won for best writer in 2011. And for those of you who don't know, the Eisner Awards are the Oscars of the comic industry. This is a strange tale. This is the IDW is willing to take some chances with this stuff, and they follow the Locke family, who moved into the creepy family estate after the murder of the patriarch of the family, and this happens to be the estate happens to be in Lovecraft, Massachusetts.
Full
circle. So, you know, the estate is full of mysterious doors with even more mysterious keys that do some very strange things. There's a very persistent, vengeful villain named Dodge that targets the Locke family. And so the bulk of the story follows the three kids. There's a little boy, the middle sister who's in junior high, and then the older brother who's in high school, and they start unlocking these horrible secrets that are throughout the house, and the keys do some really bizarro stuff, like a key that you turn to the back of your head makes the skull pop open, and quite literally you see all your fears crawl out of your head.
There's a ghost key, an echo key, a gender key, a head key, an shadow key, a giant key, a mending key, an animal key, a music box key, a skin key.
And they all do weird things. And I think one of the villain is quite treacherous, and it's got this great gender bending. There's the gender key.
Right.
And the villain alternately seduces the middle daughter and the oldest son by taking forms of these dark / gothy heroes, because they tend to, those kids lean that way anyways, and totally manipulative. It is a fantastic, bizarro tale.
I'm not as far along as Eric is. I will say, stick with it. It's like The Watchmen. If you give it time, it will reward you, but you got to stick with it.
Yeah, it's the small spoiler that it's involved. There's demons that are involved. And the Plains of Leng is involved, which is another H.P. Lovecraft throwback. Joe Hill must love him some Lovecraft in a big way. So I guess I think after I did some investigation on this, they had tried to get this filmed by Fox. And it fell through, and it got canceled. But Hulu recently has purchased the rights for it. And it looks like it's going to be made for television.
Oh, cool. Very cool.
So, you know, and I think I've just been watching the Hulu's Runaways. I think that Hulu and Amazon and Netflix are going to go toe-to-toe and coming up with these cool properties. And so this is where the opportunities for things like comics is. They're looking for the next Walking Dead, no doubt about it.
Yep. Check back in 2019.
Yep. Okay. You're number one.
Number one. I'm going way back. Way back. I tried to give a broad definition of the concept
Are you going fairy tale old?
Of folklore old.
Okay.
1755, going way back to Baba Yaga.
Baba Yaga, a great idea.
You know, I will admit I took the literature 101 series in college, never ran across Baba Yaga. My oldest boy was in a play at his middle school. They did Baba Yaga. I started to research it and read up on the tale and thought to myself, God, what a great tale. So it's a Polish-Russian folkloric tale involving this sort of like supernatural witch. It's one of the most well-developed characters in all of sort of European folklore. Of course, Baba, as you can imagine, translates roughly to, you know, old woman or grandma. It's kind of got a loving tone to it. Yaga translates roughly to snake. And the thing that's great about this story, it essentially involves an old woman who is either A, a witch, or B, just horribly disfigured and disabled, who lives out in the woods by herself. And so it takes on all these great sort of almost To Kill a Mockingbird kind of tones, where it's like you're fearful of the unknown, you're fearful of people who are different than you.
This was the kind of thing also, I think, that because of the power of folklore, these were tales told to children not to go wander out in the woods.
Right.
And this is in the very Hansel and Gretel-y kind of a
thing.
In fact, I bet you that there are probably ties between the Hansel and Gretel storyline and Baba Yaga.
I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah. But the way they leave you with the Baba Yaga character, this poor old woman in the woods, is very, very ambiguous. You know, she could be either just completely deformed and misunderstood, or she could be pure evil, which is always a great place to be in that sweet spot, which is you don't really know. And it's ultimately up to you as the reader, viewer, listener, watcher, etc., to make that decision for yourself.
But she also happens to have associated with her two absolutely fabulous modes of transportation.
Right.
One is
chicken legs.
The chicken hut.
Yeah,
she's got her house. Her hut, Baba Yaga's hut, and this is Eric's Dungeons and Dragons knowledge coming into play here.
Yes,
is that it's a magical hut that can stride the earth on gigantic chicken legs,
right?
And it was willing to go out and stomp on people who she has a grudge against. The second thing that Baba Yaga has is a flying mortise and pestle.
Yep.
And which is, it's like she doesn't ride a broom, she rides a pestle that just powered by a bowl that spins around. It's got to be that one. I think it's fantastic. I think Hollywood, call Mike Campbell.
Yes.
Sign up. I'm happy
to do a treatment.
This is
low cost.
It is
$50, six pack of beer. I'll do it.
and it's got to be better than the Snow White and the Huntsman crap that they put out.
Absolutely. All right. Let's get to that part of the podcast where we peep a little knowledge on you. We give you our picks of the week. We give you our dead and undead lists.
All right,
Eric, go first. Okay. What do you got? What should people go to that lone video store that still may or may not exist in their local community and go find?
Alternately, first thing, if you can't go to your local video store and support your local video store first. If not. Maybe it's on Amazon.
Yeah.
All right. So my undead pick of the episode is tied into some of the stuff that we've been mentioning here, and this is in my mind the best Lovecraftian treatment to date.
Ooh. Tori Spelling.
No. This is Sam Neill. This is At the Mouth of Madness.
Yeah.
From 1995, and
super scary.
Yeah. And
super freaky.
Because I was trying to, you know, when you think of At the Mountains of Madness, and oddly enough, this is At the Mouth of Madness, very similar sounding thing, that Lovecraft is hard to translate. It requires a bit of sort of literacy, I guess, not to say that people who are watching the movie are illiterate, but I think an appreciation for for the power of the written word and its ability to drive you insane.
Right.
And that's not easy to do on film. But this is Sam Neill plays a man investigating a Stephen King like horror author whose bestsellers are driving people insane, and a number of strange things happen. And as in classic Lovecraftian lore, this is sort of a detective story. And as Sam Neill, the insurance guy, goes out there and checks things out, he slowly gets driven mad, or at least you know at a certain point what's real and what's not.
Right.
Fun practical effects. The end of the thing is, you know, when, because you do, anytime you go into Lovecraft, you want the kind of crazy tentacular monster. And they give you a bit of that at the end, but they also give you kind of the mind tricks and paranoia and schizophrenia that gets tied up into a lot of this stuff. And I thought it was done really well. It didn't make a dent at all in the box office. It's largely forgotten.
Yeah.
But it had a decent budget behind it. And if you got someone like Sam Neill in it, you know, you had some good actors.
Yes. Oh yeah. Indeed.
So Mike.
Yes.
What's your undead pick of the episode?
My undead pick of the episode is the 1972 classic Three on a Meat Hook. Four girls go on a romping weekend at a lake and have car problems on their way home. A nice boy, classic tale, nice boy comes to rescue them, takes them back to his farmhouse, and things start to happen. This is a great. I will tell you the whole story because it's a great story. It's basically the father of the young boy is essentially playing with his mind and has the boy convinced that he is going out and killing these young girls because he's a strapping young, quite handsome lad who goes into the community and draws these lovely ladies out to the farmhouse, and then they end up dying. Super slow burn on this one. I mean, you got to wait till like the last minute of the film to get the punchline. But the punchline is, it's not the son killing the young lovelies. It's the old man killing the young lovelies,
and
so that he can feed the mother, who turned out to have a taste for human flesh. The mom is a cannibal. And the boy, throughout the entire film, thinks that the mom is dead.
So, now, I haven't seen it yet.
It's good.
But I've heard that it is, of the era, it was a very gross movie.
There's some pretty gross stuff in it. There's a lot of, it is, you know, I will say, it's pretty mundane. It's really slow. I don't know that there's better copies out there. Like, if somebody's got a 35mm print parked in their basement that they need to digitize, it probably needs to happen because the one on Amazon is pretty thin.
Oh.
But
someone called the Hollywood Theater and said there's a master cut.
Yes. But it's good. It's a good film. So what do you got for your dead? The film that should stay dead and people should stay the hell away from.
Okay, this is my dead pan.
Yes.
also thematic for what we're talking about today, I warned that there hasn't yet been a good horror movie based on a video game, and I think the poster child for that is Doom.
Yes.
Oh my god, that was a bad movie.
It was.
And I knew it was going to be a bad movie, and I watched it anyways.
Yeah.
This is prototype of bad video game meets horror movie. It actually had a good budget. It had The Rock in it.
Right.
It had Carl Urban in it. So, you know that they had
not Keith Urban.
Yeah, not
Carl Urban.
Carl Urban. Yeah. Ain't no country music being played in this one. This movie gave me a headache.
Mm-hmm.
It was all, and this is, you know, when I realized that they shouldn't try and do Dead Space.
Right.
It's like, I think Dead Space would do it like Doom, because I think that, I will admit that, like, Doom sort of introduced you to running around in a maze,
right,
shooting monsters, and they would jump out and go boo, and it would spook the shit out of you.
Yep.
Doesn't mean it's going to make a good movie. There's no plot.
Right.
At least a third of the movie is trying to recreate the feel of the video game by putting you in sort of shaky cam first person with the gun in front of you. It looks ridiculous. It's terrible. It's just an abysmally bad plot, and I think it's one of the reasons why, you know, they try and throw big money at video game movies that are super successful. Doom is a huge multi-million dollar moneymaker for video games, and yet, you know, I think that what is difficult with video games is that the visceral part of it is that you feel like you're actually taking part in the game. You are taking you're an integral component to it.
Right.
Movies give you a step removed from that. And how does that translate? It as of yet it hasn't been done, and so this is
it's a 2-hour headache.
It is. It's just it's a
hour and 20-minute headache.
They dragged out a threadbare plot.
Yep.
It was.
Stay away from dude.
I knew it was going to be bad, and it was.
Stay away.
Dude. Keep it buried. So, Mr. Campbell, what is your dead pick?
My dead pick is a more recent film. It's a 2016 film that Netflix has been pimping the hell out of called Killing Ground. It's an Australian film.
It's not good.
It's a couple's camping trip that turns into a frightening ordeal when they stumble across the scene of a horrific crime. So here's the thing I didn't like about Killing Ground. It's the actors are really good. It's got a great premise. There's a really terrifying scene when the family gets abducted. The only person left alive is this literally a little baby, like probably like a 18 month old, and the little baby comes stumbling out of the woods, but the little baby is about 100 yards behind the protagonist in the film. Just terrifying to see that. I mean, it kind of breaks your heart. But it's essentially, you know, it's essentially like a home invasion film out in the woods. The problem with the film for me was that they explore sort of the they explore the character development behind the protagonists, but they also explore some character development behind the people doing the killing, these two sort of backwoods types in Australia. But the problem is they don't explore it enough. So they introduce you to these guys, you see what they're up to, they get up to it, but they don't give you any sense or reason why. Now, it's fine if it's the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, it's fine if it's Jason, it's fine if it's Freddy, but in this case, they give you a little bit too much about the people, but then they don't really, at the end of the day, there's no payoff. They don't explain to you who these people are or why the hell they would go out and kill families in the woods.
Well, there's a common criticism for the reboots of things like Halloween and Friday the 13th, where they're trying to give motivations.
Right.
Thin. I mean, in the end, they end up being thin motivations for, like, the reboot of Freddy.
Right.
And the reboot of Jason in particular.
Right.
Where it's like, people aren't going for the motivations.
Right. And I agree. And in those cases, there should be no motivation. In this case, if you're introducing somebody who's not supernatural, who just happens to live out in the woods, you gotta have some... There has to be some exigence for their killing.
Yeah. And they
don't give it to you.
I mean, there are some things, like, with Get Out, the antagonists have this fabulous... the motivations are, and so not to say that you can't have properly motivated villains. It's just that if you half-ass it, if you try and you blow it, you just wasted half of your movie.
Right. Right. So, yeah. All right.
Disappointing. So anyhow, that
good week.
That is a good week.
Good week for horror.
And it's been a good year for horror.
Yes.
Coming to a close. And so we're going to just send you off here with. A reminder, if there's a noise above you,
yes,
it's probably too late. It's got the jump on you. Until next episode. Goodbye.